Hello and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fine Water Podcast Network, I am your host, Rob Kelly. Our subject this month is icon Sidney Poitier. Born in 1927, Poitier grew up in the Bahamas, not experiencing the modern world until he was 10, when the family moved to Nassau. It was there he first saw cars, refrigeration, electricity, indoor plumbing, and movies. Poitier moved to New York at age 16 to become an actor, but he had difficulty reading scripts and had to find work as a dishwasher. An elderly waiter that Poitier worked with helped him learn to read by going over the newspaper every night for months. After lying about his age to serve in the Army during World War II, Poitier finally landed a role with the American Negro Theater. While there, he befriended another young performer named Harry Belafonte. Poitier was then offered a role in the 1950 drama No Way Out, starring Richard Widmark as a racist convict who doesn't want to be treated by a black doctor, played by Poitier. He continued to work in films, appearing in the 1955 hit The Blackboard Jungle and 1957's Edge of the City. He then co-starred with Tony Curtis in Stanley Kramer's The Defiant Ones, a huge critical and commercial hit. It earned Poitier an Academy Award nomination, making him the first African-American actor to be nominated for a lead role. In 1961, he starred in the film adaptation of the groundbreaking play A Raisin in the Sun, then co-starred with Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward in Paris Blues. He played the lead in 1963's Lilies of the Field, winning the Oscar for Best Actor, making him the first African-American to ever win that award. He continued to work in big Hollywood productions, and then, in 1967, he appeared in three smash hits in a row, To Serve with Love, In the Heat of the Night, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Not only were the three films critically and commercially successful, but they had massive cultural impact, turning Poitier into the number one draw at the box office that year. In between two sequels to In the Heat of the Night, Poitier began a directing career, doing double duty as director and star for the 1972 Western Buck and the Preacher, co-starring Harry Belafonte. He did the same the following year for the romantic drama A Warm December. He did three films with Bill Cosby, Uptown Saturday Night, Let's Do It Again, and A Piece of the Action, with the pair playing different characters each time. He put aside acting to concentrate on directing and helmed the 1980 prison comedy Stir Crazy starring Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder, which was a huge hit. Poitier returned to acting in 1988 with the thriller Shoot to Kill, then was part of the ensemble cast of 1992's Sneakers, which became a cult hit. He worked in TV movies and wrote his autobiography before returning to movie screens in 1997's The Jackal, which would be his last film. His legend now secure, Sidney Poitier passed away in 2022 at the age of 94. Here with me to discuss The Jackal and the career of Sidney Poitier is my pal, Professor Annie Burkhardt. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Rob. It's been a few years.
It has been a few years. I was going to say the last time we recorded together, which was on an episode of Pod Dylan, you were not a professor, but you're one now. So congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you. I'm living the luxurious life, you know, in this country at this time, being a professor, what could be better?
Education? What is that about? Why don't you explain to people what you are a professor of?
Sure. Well, I hold a PhD in English from the University of Iowa, which I got in 2024. And right from there, I shuttled out here to Northern Colorado, where I teach writing, mostly first year gen ed writing courses for now, but hoping to teach some literature courses, which could turn into some music history courses, which could take us all the way back to Pod Dylan.
There we go.
everything comes back around. Everything goes in cycles, you know.
May I ask, what is it like dealing with the young generation? I don't really have much interaction. We don't have kids, so we don't have a lot of interaction with that. What's your feeling about dealing with college kids?
Well, I'll start by saying I'm child-free by choice, but they are fierce about their values, whatever those may be. And I really, really respect that.
That is good. Again, congratulations. I knew you were working towards that, but when we were on Pod Dylan and you've achieved it, and that's absolutely amazing. So, and again, thank you. I always wanted to have you on one of my shows, you know, again, after Pod Dylan ended, and I'm so glad that you agreed to do this. And so, of all the people, why Sidney Poitier?
Well, I'm just kind of enchanted by him. And that's kind of my core observation that I hope we can keep coming back to as we converse and discuss his very, very long list of achievements and his really, really varied and extensive filmography. But I do think like the idea of like, okay, I'm a white person who's been incredibly enchanted by Sidney Poitier for over half my life now. What are the problems inherent in that? Because like enchanted is a very specific sort of word that can conjure up feelings of like exoticizing or like, hey, wow, look at that noble savage over there and all that stuff. So I want to make sure we keep coming back to that. There is actually even a chapter in his memoir, The Measure of a Man, and the chapter is titled, Why Do White People Love Sidney Poitier So? And it's a great, and like I listened to it on audiobook. I got him narrating. It was
Oh, that's cool.
really fantastic to hear his take on that. And I don't like, in addition to that, he kind of just drops out of nowhere his whole theory about like faith and the universe. Like he's a really big into Carl Sagan and all of the thought that comes around that. So like, I fell in love with him at a very young age for very different reasons. And now that I've done this incredibly deep dive on him, I'm just finding that like he and I are more aligned than I could have ever possibly imagined on every score. But like most wonderful things in life, I came to him by way of Katharine Hepburn. She's accounted for a lot of my fun in life. Like, I don't know if you and your wife Kelly have ever tried the Katharine Hepburn brownie recipe. If you haven't, please
No.
do. It will change your life. I absolutely guarantee it. Lots of chocolate and lots of butter, though. That's basically her
Okay, I
secret.
mean, she lived to be like 97 too,
I
so
know, like it clearly worked for her, whatever it was. But yeah, so my mom, hi mom, excellent second wave feminist, surely going to be the first listener of this episode when it drops. She started me early on Katharine Hepburn. I think by the time I was 11 or 12, I was watching Bringing Up Baby and Desk Set in particular, just over and over. And as I matured and like developed more emotional intelligence and romantic sensibilities, I, of course, like most people, was really, really taken by the chemistry between Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy in Desk Set. And I didn't know anything about them off screen. I didn't know this decades long relationship where they may or may not have been beards for each other and gay. Like, I just, whatever it was, they clearly loved each other very much. And that really came through in Desk Set. So I was just kind of looking around at the filmography and, like, I don't remember how, but of course, I landed on Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. It doesn't really matter why I landed there next, but I know it was the next one I got to. And I had absolutely no idea what I was getting into. I had no idea that it was immediately going to become a comfort movie that I would watch dozens, if not close to 100 more times between then and now, which is 15 plus years later. And the thing is, it's not a five-star movie by any stretch of the imagination. It's very of its time. It's not like this masterpiece. I mean, like it was a masterpiece in its time, perhaps. We can talk about that, but it's hard to watch it now without like even cringing at some of the more progressive for 1967 parts. But I did just find going in expecting to be really focused on Hepburn and Tracy and just being like, who is that?
Yeah, oh, he is
It's
lights
so,
out in that movie.
yeah. Like, so of course, I got really lucky. The first thing I saw from him was in his absolute best year by all accounts. And he's truly irresistible. I remember so clearly the scene at Katharine Hepburn's gallery where Joey and John Prentice go in before they even meet the parents and all that stuff. And Sydney's character just gets like fascinated by this little artistic machine thing. And he's not putting on a show for the people at the gallery. He's just like very, very genuinely into this little masterpiece. And he locks eyes with this very clearly racist woman who doesn't want him to be there and is just charm itself. And I think anybody who's seen that, even just the movie itself, but especially that scene, will know what I'm talking about, and we're probably just as charmed as I was. And I assume anyone listening to this podcast hopefully enjoys movies a great deal and knows this feeling, but I just felt this immediate kinship to him. Like, just in the way he carried himself, the way he expressed himself, this sort of what felt like a very organic quality, organic and admirable. And again, then we're coming back to like, am I calling him a noble savage or something? I don't know what to do with that. But I have found the hardest thing about prepping for this podcast appearance is actually trying to put words to what I saw in him in that moment. And the best I've landed on is a playful, yet dignified, yet also subdued grace and like a soft-spoken dignity. And just in that moment, I felt like I sort of intuited that, I don't think this is completely the Dr. John Prentice character. I feel like to be this convincing in this kind of way, there has to be a great deal of Sidney Poitier in it. Again, it was kind of a dangerous guess because what was I assuming about the type of person he was and the type of representative he was for Black entertainment at that time? But the more I've expanded my knowledge on him, watched him in more roles, but then especially listened to him narrate two of his memoirs, that is 100% him. And it's been a wild ride and a joy. What is your experience with Sydney thus far?
Well, that's okay. I mean, obviously, we can't go through all of his films because we just don't have the time to do, all of them dignity. So, as is typical with the show, we'll sort of trip hammer through the career and talk about some more than others. But Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is a great place to start because that was, as far as I can remember, the first time I ever saw him. Was when I worked at the video store, which I've mentioned virtually every episode. And that was, I rented Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And I loved that movie from the get-go, right? I just thought, I've always loved Tracy Hepburn, and I've loved Stanley Kramer. We covered him on this show a couple of years ago. Like my Letterboxd four faves, two of the movies are Stanley Kramer movies. So, I absolutely loved his movies, and I loved Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. I absolutely loved Poitier's speech with his father about, "I'm your child. I don't owe you anything, right? You brought me into this world. I don't owe you anything." And that gave voice to a feeling that I had sort of had in the back of my head, but had never quite verbalized or had heard verbalized. And so to hear someone say it in a movie that was made a full half decade before I was even born was very powerful. And because I've always been of the belief that each person, you are your own thing. You don't owe anything to anybody, and so to hear him sort of state that, and I think he just gives a masterful performance in that film. And so I always loved that movie, right? And then over the years, I did reading of it, and as you say, it was very hip and very contemporary in 1967. And of course, something that's very hip at the time is not going to age as well because it's going to look a little a little eye-rolly. And there are moments of that movie that are very eye-rolly. But over the years, I read about it and there was a lot of criticism of of course, Sidney Poitier is the absolute perfect example. He's like the absolute flawless African American. And that's why that movie can be dismissed because he's not really, flawed. And I was like, well, but isn't that the point? Isn't that the point of it? Is that the Tracy Hepburn characters still have a problem even though this guy is an accomplished doctor and he works for the UN, like he couldn't be more successful and renowned. And they still have a problem. And the reason they have a problem is because he's black. That's the problem. And so I always thought, well, that's the, I never quite understood. But at the same time, I always felt a little shy about loving that movie as much as I did because I saw so much relentless criticism of it. And now I've kind of come around the other side. I'm like, no. I love that movie. It was groundbreaking in 1967. Yeah, it looks a little square now, but who cares? You can put yourself back to 1967. So I love that movie. And he is just, I mean, imagine, he had been in movies for 10 years at that point, but imagine being able to hold your own with Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn in their last film together, because that's Spencer Tracy's last film, being able to go toe to toe with them, like stay on screen and not get blown off the screen. Just amazing. So he is, he's just so great in that film.
No, it's utterly mind-blowing. And kind of like you were saying, one of my favorite scenes is when Spencer Tracy's character like goes into the study and decides, hey, I'm going to call around about this guy,
Yep.
see what I can find out about Dr. John Wade Prentice. And his list of accomplishments, like he actually just hangs up on the woman he called
It, she just keeps going with
she's like, do you want me to keep going? He's like disappointedly saying, ugh. No, I guess not. Thanks for your time, you know? And that does get to exactly what your point is. Like, it really didn't matter if he would have been the Pope, if he would have actually been Nelson Mandela. He did play Mandela later, but like, you know, it wouldn't have mattered. It was because he was marrying the white daughter. And it's just. And to me, like it is always going to be a, like 5 stars on Letterboxd. So, like I'm with you, Rob. I just have that attachment to and appreciation for it. But what's interesting that I've learned in reading his memoir is that holding his own with Catherine and Spencer was not like a struggle for him acting wise, but getting them to be willing. To be absolutely sure that they wanted to do the movie, there was a whole like vetting process going on by them. Even and he says over and over, these are wonderful, progressive, white, liberal people who were still just like, we need to get to know this guy before we feel like we can commit to this movie. And Sidney says very, very compellingly, like there was a time when. There was actually a dinner party that I was invited to with Catherine and Spencer
Oh my
because
God.
they wanted to check me out. So it's like
Can you
it the
imagine?
whole story was playing out in micro in real life beforehand. And of course they came around to it quickly, but and came around to him quickly because like we're saying, you can't possibly resist. And of course, we know him to be one of the finest actors of all time, period. But it took them a while and he understood, but it's just crazy how revolutionary it all was for that you even see these real people, Catherine and Spencer, who are in real life, just like, is this too much of a risk to like put our careers through this, to marry our careers to this black guy, you know, for the space of this movie. And so it's like almost that protectiveness that you see with Joey in the movie. It's like with their careers and handing it over to Sydney. And then we can also think of just like kind of the whole cultural zeitgeist around it playing out in macro. Like this movie is Sydney's big opportunity to charm people and possibly change their minds, not just about black entertainers, but about black people, which I think is very, very easy to overlook. And I think, I mean, he clearly won a lot of people over, and it's amazing.
I cannot imagine the pressure on someone like him, because he all of a sudden becomes he is the only black leading man in Hollywood. He's the through that entire time, he's the only one. That amount of pressure put on him had to have been unbelievably crushing. Or maybe not. Maybe, I'm sure it was a burden. Maybe it wasn't crushing because he seemed to handle it quite well, but that's so much pressure to kind of be like perfect and also represent every aspect of the African American experience, which he cannot. And obviously, I have no clue about speaking to that, but like, that's it's not like he could, there are other actors that he could share that burden with. It was just him for the longest time. I mean, when I was looking up one of the films that he did, the Bedford Incident, I went to watch the Bedford Incident with that he did with his friend Richard Widmark. Now, he made that in 1965. And I read a little factoid that said he had been doing movies for 10 years at that point, 13 years. It is the first,
15.
yeah, it is the first film that he did that does not have race enter into the storyline in any way. Imagine that. Imagine having to
There's
do movies for a decade, and every single time there has to be some aspect of your blackness, and it's like, I just want to play a person. And he didn't get to do it until 1965. It's like, that's just had to have been so daunting in so many ways to deal with that burden.
No, I can't even imagine. I remember seeing that factoid too, and I hadn't, like, I saw that after I watched it, and I hadn't put that together because I had been watching everything chronologically. At that point, I had watched all of his movies all the way through up to that point, and like it just hadn't occurred to me. And like then I was able to look back at that other like 15 years worth of movies and have this extra reverence and respect and kind of awe for what he was doing. Like I remember he talked about how in his very first acting class at the American Negro Theater, Harry Belafonte was there. But then like what happened to him? I don't, maybe you know better than I do. Like I don't know how it took him so like took his rise to fame. Like it took him longer for some reason, but like Sidney was just out there in the forefront, kind of carrying it for almost 2 decades, it felt like.
It's unreal. So okay, we can what let's okay, we can just sort of jump around what movies of his we want to discuss. So which pick one that you wanna talk about a little bit.
Sure. I kind of want to start with his very first movie, No Way Out.
Okay. All right, with Richard Widmark.
You watched that as well,
I
right?
did. I did.
That kind of blew my mind.
That movie takes a unbelievably dark turn that you would not expect.
It does, and there are a few like that. I think we can all agree that Edge of the City was very much like that as well. But that very first one, like I didn't necessarily expect him to be playing like such a prominent, like one of the lead roles in his very first film. And I didn't know what to expect at all going into it, but just from the get-go, you get that same, like you're looking at this black doctor who is getting nothing but vitriol from this guy in the hospital that he's just trying to help. And then the guy tries to frame him. Like just, and again, it's just for being black. So like from the get-go, he is put into that position of trying to show us that the dude trying to frame him is wrong, that the dude accusing him is wrong.
I mean, it opens with like the whole setup of it for anyone who hasn't seen it, and I guess most people probably have not, is that it's Richard Widmark is a prisoner. And he gets wounded in jail, and they bring him to the prison jail. And Sidney Poitier is his doctor. And of course, Richard Widmark is just an absolute, the character, by the way, not the actor, the character that he's playing is an inveterate racist. And he doesn't want to, as I mentioned in the intro, he doesn't want to be treated by Sidney Poitier just because he's black. And you're kind of like, oh, okay, I sort of see what this is going to be. That right, this is it's well done, but I can sort of see where this is going. And then you don't, because halfway through there his friends are like, hey, let's start a race war. And it's basically where the film goes. And all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, this is what this movie's about? Like, oh my God, what a turn. This movie takes
Exactly. And
I mean
I don't know if it was supposed to like be the artistic triumph that I made it in my head after a while. Like in my head I was like, okay, so they're trying to show us the dissonance between what someone like Sidney Poitier's character is and how people see black people. The thing is, I don't know if that's what the people writing and directing the film we're actually going for. In my head, it's like, okay, they're showing us this dissonance. But I actually don't, maybe you know, or maybe nobody has any clue. Maybe it really is just like this weird, unhinged turn. I don't know.
I mean, it was written by and directed by Joseph Mankiewicz, who was, all about Eve and, certainly one of the great filmmakers. So I have to assume that, yeah, he was like, all right, I'm gonna take on this issue and present it in a way that's gonna be kind of unpalatable, but that's what we're gonna do. And it's 1950. I will say it was really funny. There's this great moment where early in the film where Richard Widmark protests. He's like, I don't want to be treated by this guy. And some prison guard drags him away, and no one's listening to him. And Widmark goes, "Don't I have any rights?" And the guard goes, "No." And I laughed really hard at that. And I'm like, wow, I've seen whole comedies where I didn't laugh as hard as I did at that one line of just the way they're kind of like, shut up, you stupid racist. No, we're not dealing with this. And it's Poitier just, he's precise and sort of like he can't, kind of was just saying earlier, like, he's carrying this burden. He can't be the real person he wants to be, right? He can't tell Richard Widmark's character, look, you stupid, right? Like, he can't say the things because he's got to be professional. And so he has to use that kind of very clipped, even-keeled language. And he very rarely loses his temper throughout the film. And I have to feel like that was Poitier at large, right? In almost all of his movies, he couldn't let it rip because, again, he had so much pressure on him to be a certain exemplar of a kind of figure. And so it's a great start. I mean, it's a great start to be in this movie. And he did this two-hander with Mark, and they apparently formed a great friendship, and they appeared in several films. I already mentioned The Bedford Incident. That's another movie that takes an incredible turn at the end of the movie. But they went on and had a great friendship. So yeah, I mean, it's a tremendous start to his career, and it's a great movie. Now, one of the ones I watched early on in his career, because after he does No Way Out, he kind of does a bunch of smaller films, and then kind of comes back up with Blackboard Jungle, which is a big hit. But one of the ones I wanted to mention was Go Man Go. Did you watch that?
Yes,
Okay.
I did. That was just like that was the Globetrotters, right?
That Go Man Go is like a Mad Libs of a movie, because it is like, it's a movie about, proper noun, the Harlem Globetrotters, starring Sidney Poitier, directed by cinematographer James Wong Howe. Like, what? What? This is, and yet that's what it is. It's a movie about the Harlem Globetrotters, and Sidney Poitier plays one of the players. It's not a particularly great movie. It For a movie, quote unquote, about the origins of the Harlem Globetrotters, it's really about a white guy mostly, which is a
Well,
little
that's the
disappointing.
thing. Like, if
But
you look at the poster, it's like the white couple, the romance. So it's like a
yeah.
movie starring Sidney Poitier about the Harlem
The Harlem
Globetrotters,
Globetrotters.
starring, featuring, actually about the two,
Yeah.
the straight white guy and the straight white woman. Just like it's just kind of baffling how easy it can be to, I don't know, sweep what matters under the rug. However, it was fun. It was kind of harmless fun.
It's
I'd say,
good-hearted. It's a good-hearted movie.
yeah. And like the music was outstanding. Just really a nice like breath of fresh air after you had stuff like Cry Beloved Country and like really just everything that was so racially charged. He jumped right into it, like very political as well, like shooting. What was it like on site in South Africa for Cry Beloved Country?
I
Like
think so, yeah.
they dropped him straight into just some crazy serious roles. And at least this you can like just take a breath for a minute. That's
Yeah, I just
what
like.
I felt, watching his entire filmography, just these moments where you just could breathe, where you weren't like clenching every muscle in your body and all
Right.
that stuff. Yeah,
Well,
that was
you mentioned Edge of the City. Let's talk about Edge of the City. That's the two-hander he does with John Cassavetes. And that's first of all, great Martin Ritt, directed by Martin Ritt, a terrific movie. You turned me on to it, and I like John Cassavetes, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna see this. But Poitier is really fun in that, and he's the kind of loose guy, right? It's Cassavetes who we find out later on in the film is basically AWOL and working under an assumed identity. So of course he's very tense. But it's Poitier who is this kind of loosey-goosey kind of guy. And it's fun to see him in that kind of role, right? To not be the controlled guy. He's the one who's trying to like, hey man, relax. It's all good. We're working here as, stevedores, it's all good. And they have a great rapport together.
They do, and it's so appealing to see both of them really together in this like scrappy sort of blue collar, deep, deep friendship where they're very, very protective of each other, even before there's like the tremendous, tremendous, tremendous danger to life and limb that kind of comes very suddenly later. But I was so charmed by Sydney, and honestly, like, and both of them, honestly. It just whenever they locked eyes, like I took some screenshots of them like at various moments, just and I felt honestly like those were some of the most passionate looks that I saw in his whole filmography. Those were just there was something really, really moving in that. And just kind of for me, someone who studies like queer culture and stuff like that. I'm not saying it was like straight up gay, but just the privileging of something like a deep platonic bond and saying, hey, this is as interesting as a straight romance would be. I felt that with them. And it also, I think that was also the first movie I saw where there was just this big protracted scene where we get to watch Sydney dance. And I wish I'd kept a tally because it happens in like every other movie. There's like at least a dozen where they give him a dance scene, which again could have like some racial implications. I'm not saying it's like great necessarily, but it's very fun to watch, and he's clearly enjoying himself.
Yes. Yeah, that's a really terrific little drama. During this time, right? He does the Blackboard Jungle. He's co-starring with Glenn Ford. He does the Defiant Ones, which was obviously a massive hit. And I have to think that as his star is rising, he's getting paired up with these white stars, which is a way for Hollywood to kind of ingratiate him into with audiences, right? Because they're not ready to kind of make him be the lead. It's like, no. Like, look, he's with Tony Curtis. You like Tony Curtis. He's with John Cassavetes. You like John Cassavetes. He's with Richard Widmark. You like that. And that's a way of Hollywood to kind of slowly introduce him and get people used to the idea. Now, that might not have been the plan, but that seems to be where it's going. And then he does A Raisin in the Sun, which I had never seen. And I watched it, and I remember you said when I mentioned it on Blue Sky that I was watching, and you said that you really loved that play, right? I thought that's what you had said.
Yes.
That film is an all black cast, except for like this one character, one awful character who's trying to get them to move. But it's an all black, but it's a play written by an African American woman about African American people, and it's for an African American audience. I mean, obviously, it's you as a white person, you can watch it, but it's not aimed at white audiences. It's aimed at black audiences, and I feel like that's a turn that he takes in his career. And I think that was a terrific movie. Obviously, I've never seen the play or anything about it, but he is tremendous in that, as is everyone else in that film. And it's also very heartbreaking, what they have to deal with in multiple ways throughout that film.
Absolutely, and you can feel in every syllable that like this cast had been working together, traveling together for literally years, putting this on live every other night for a while. But it's like they also weren't over practiced to the point where anything got stale. They brought the entire original cast, I think, even including the one white guy. I think it was everybody. I think it was all the original cast, and they just brought something really special. Like most of it just takes place in one room, and you feel like you're getting leagues and leagues and acres of story. And what intrigues me about what you said here very, very kind of astutely is like, I do think it, you're right, it is for Black audiences. And when it's for a Black audience, we have Sydney's first like deplorable character that I can remember. He doesn't have a whole lot of them in his whole filmography, but God, that guy is really hard to like. He, you know, like most kind of maybe haunted or traumatized or whatever, most like more abrasive characters. He did have a moment where we thought everything was going to be okay. We thought just everything was finally settling a little bit, that he had changed his ways and all of this stuff. And it made it even the more like all the more heartbreaking when it all kind of falls back apart, the house fall, like everything falls through. And to me, it was just honestly, it was very jarring to watch Sydney in a role where I didn't like him. But for me, it was all the more powerful for that. But it was uncomfortable. So I was trying to like sit with the fact that it was uncomfortable and try to make something of that. Was that kind of your experience?
Yeah, I think so. Again, it was nice to see him in a variation of something, but it's I like when I mean, look, Roger Ebert, the late great Roger Ebert, famously said that movies are empathy machines, right? Because they're putting you in the driver's seat of someone else's life who you might not get to experience. And if you're open to it, you can, and the movie is good, it can convey something about the human condition that hopefully is universal, whatever. And I just, it's, yeah, it was neat to see him in that different light, but yet, he makes really stupid mistakes in that movie. Really, really stupid mistakes. And you're frustrated, but you also understand why he's doing it. The family is frustrated, everything. And so it's, again, watching it, I knew, I'm like, okay, this movie's not really aimed at me, but yet I'm drawn in because it's, I guess it's just well done and the performances are great. And I'm like, how many movies did he and Ruby Dee play husband and wife, right? I think they did like five movies together where like she's his wife. But it's, yeah, it was fun to see him in a, I don't know if I didn't, I don't know if I disliked him. I don't know if I would go that far, but he was frustrating because he does dumb stuff, understandable, but dumb stuff. And on a completely side note, I also know actors are actors, but the guy who is constantly trying to get Poitier's family to not move into the white, quote unquote, white neighborhood is actor John Fiedler, who is juror number two from 12 Angry Men and the voice of Piglet. And like, I love him from 12 Angry Men, and just seeing him as this horrible racist just was like, oh, I don't, I don't want to see
Oh my
poor
gosh.
John,
Yeah. Like,
John Fiedler. I don't want you being racist towards Sidney Poitier. It's deeply upsetting. So,
and like Piglet sitting in someone's living room, like referring to this family as you people
oh
over and
God,
over.
oh God. And he keeps saying it. Well, you people. I'm like, oh my
It
God.
was at least four times. Like, it may have been like a great deal more than that. It felt like every other sentence, honestly. But I mean, he was very good at this role where he really thinks he's being nice, but he's making everything so much worse and making everybody feel terrible.
So another one right around this time that I really wanted to ask you about, because I think we're on the same page on this, but maybe not, is Lilies of the Field. That's the one where he wins the Oscar for Best Actor. And I had never seen that film, right? He makes history. He's the first African American to win the lead actor Oscar. And I'm like, this is historic. And I watched this movie and I'm like, really? This is what he won for? And not because the performance is bad, but the movie is so slight. It is so, it's like he goes and he works for a bunch of nuns out in the desert, and the nuns are kind of wacky. And like, that's the movie. And I was shocked that I was like, this is what he won for? And I then did some research, and when I learned that, I thought, Was this Hollywood's? And then, okay, let me back up. Not only does he win the Oscar for that movie, he then does not get nominated again. He doesn't get nominated for Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. He doesn't get nominated for In the Heat of the Night. He doesn't get nominated for To Serve with Love. And not that winning an Oscar or being nominated for an Oscar is the sum to, like, well, it wasn't worth it if he didn't get nominated for an Oscar. I'm not saying that. But the idea that he wins an award for something so slight and yet doesn't get recognized for some of the most iconic, but obviously more problematic to white audiences roles. I was like, was that Hollywood's way of sort of saying, yeah, we're not racist. We gave him an Oscar and then never again. And then I learned when reading about him and his personal life, he was worried about that. He had that same worry that he was being kind of pushed into this role of like, oh, that's what white audiences, that's what Hollywood is going to give me an award for, is something safe and where all the edges are sand down. And so he was genuinely worried about it too. And I don't know. I thought you, did you have the same reaction to that film?
Yes, like I enjoy it. I love it. It's fun. But the thing is, it's harmless. And we shouldn't be giving our first ever Oscar to a black person for something harmless, probably. But I mean, or if we do, at least come back around and
Right. You
nominate
want to give him
him.
that one, that's fine, but nominate him for this other stuff that's groundbreaking, you know?
I think, like, everything he did in 1967, To Serve with Love, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, In the Heat of the Night, all of those could have potentially been Oscar-winning roles, each and every one of them, potentially. And the fact that there was not even a nod there with any of those, like, he even kind of expanded on that in both of his memoirs and noted that, like, for Box Top, excuse me, why am I blanking on the name? Sorry, TBI moment. Box office, here we go. So for box office numbers for 1967, the number one, number two, and number three movies, the top grossing movies, were all Sidney Poitier movies.
It's unreal. That's an unreal run.
So how, like, and nothing for that year and nothing after that, as like, oh, I'm sorry, we messed up, so we're gonna give you this kind of retroactively for a less interesting role, like, just nothing. And it's, I do think that's disappointing, and I do think it's kind of what you're saying, speaking to some sort of milquetoast sensibilities that were certainly in the Academy back then. And honestly, I think we do still see that sometimes today, like we want to give sort of the DEI award to somebody as long as they don't make us too uncomfortable. If that, and I think when after you watched Lilies of the Field, you texted me and said, so he got the Oscar for gently chiding some nuns. That's right.
It's
That's what
again,
it is.
it's not a bad movie, everybody. I don't mean to say it's not a bad movie, but it's just harmless and slight. And I just couldn't believe, I figured for a guy to win, the first African American to win an Oscar for best actor, man, this Lilies of the Field has got to be something, right? I figured it had to be. And then I watched it and I kept waiting for something sort of dramatic to happen. It kind of doesn't. And I was just like, wow. And it's reminiscent of like the Academy. I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on this because we're here to talk about Sidney Poitier, but it's like, the Academy Award isn't going to give Denzel Washington the Oscar for Malcolm X, but they'll give it for Training Day because he's a criminal in that one. And that's a little easier for them to tolerate than it is for him playing Malcolm X. And you look at that now and you're like, it's one of the most titanic performances anybody's ever given. How did he not win it for Malcolm X? That's insane. And I just feel like, is that what that is? And so yeah, Lilies of the Field, just such a slight little movie, and yet that's the thing that got him. And you're just like, wow, well, okay. I mean, good. I'm glad he got it, but still, I mean,
And I
oof.
also, like, he at least got nominated for Edge of the City, and to me, that's also up there. Like, I mean, I'm glad he at least got one other nomination, but the fact that there were none after, what was it, 1963 with Lilies of the Fields, and he was acting until in like proper Hollywood movies until 97, that's just wild to me. And sometimes I wonder, was something like In the Heat of the Night, Sidney, he himself changed. He was the one who begged to be able to slap the guy back after he got slapped. That was not in the script. And Sidney just said that I can't act it like this, because he had a very big sort of moral compass and like real acting conscience. Like there were times that he turned down roles just because he couldn't even verbalize exactly why he would turn down a by all accounts really, really stellar role that would elevate his career, as if he needed that, and all these things. And just, yeah, so in that moment he was like, I can't, when this guy slaps me, what is it, like Chief Gillespie or something like that, slaps him.
Well, it's
And
the it's Rod Steiger's character is watching
right,
it,
okay,
but
yes, of course.
he slaps the guy that they're questioning about this murder, and
Yes,
he's
yes.
yeah, and Poitier just hauls right. It's got one of the most iconic scenes of movies, right, in the last 100 years now.
No, and like there was no slapback in the original script. And I just wonder, not that it would have been okay in his mind to keep it as it was and win an Oscar for that, but I do wonder if he had stood there and stoically accepted that slap in the way that he accepted all of the other metaphorical slaps beginning in No Way Out, would that have made the difference? It could have, actually, with that academy, with those sensibilities. But I thought that was an awesome discovery that he pushed for that. And he was a stickler for the timing too, that it was less than a split second and he just slaps him right back.
Boom, right back.
Just got a truly iconic moment.
And again, the pressure that's because as an actor, you're having to think about the character and what would this character do in this moment. You have all those pressures on you, and then on top of it, you also know you are the only African American lead actor out there working. Like all that, layer it on top of like, why could I put more? Could I have more pressure on myself for Pete's sake? So we've been talking about some of the bigger ones that people know. What is one that's an obscure Sidney to you, an obscure Sidney Poitier movie that you would point to somebody who was listening and was like, okay, I know the big ones, but what's one that most people don't know that you would want to highlight?
No hesitation, The Slender Thread with Anne
Anne
Bancroft.
Bancroft, yep.
Oh my God, that I was on the edge of my seat, glued to the screen. Sometimes we just put movies on in the background, which I gotta be honest, as I was getting later in his career, and to me it felt like in a lot of cases, a lot of the same genre that just doesn't speak to me in the same way, like more crime stuff, just kind of Sidney Poitier shooting guns, which is fun for a while, but maybe a little lackluster after a while. Yeah, The Slender Thread. It's like this little, it's so intimate. And I just like I couldn't turn my eyes away from any second of it. And like it's really just this slice of life thing. It's the fact that it's between two people who never meet, just for anyone
Yeah,
listening.
explain to people what the premise of it is. It's a terrific premise.
So Sidney Poitier's character is working at, it's a crisis center, a crisis call center, I believe. And I think he was like a psychiatry graduate student. Do you happen to recall, Rob?
Something
He
like that, yeah.
in some sort of capacity working in a crisis call center. And Anne Bancroft calls him from a hotel room after already having taken several pills to try to kill herself. And she's not in her own home. They spend the entire time on the phone together. And it's just amazing how all of this works. her husband ends up coming to the crisis facility, and like it at least ostensibly, the reason she's doing this is because of her horribly terrible and abusive husband. And we're just it's really just a master class in not just acting, but on a story and narrative level, like what difference just one person can make to another in as like especially just in a crisis circumstance. I don't know. I found it so touching.
It's a great
And
movie. It's a directed by Sydney Pollack, an early film by Sydney Pollack. And the fact that they're on the phone with each other, after a while, you really start to forget that they're not in the same scene together, right? It just doesn't occur to you anymore that they're not in the same. Sometimes they're in the same frame where they do a split screen, but you're like, well, these two are actually not in the same set at any point. And you just start to forget about it because they're so good together.
And it's crazy to me that, yeah, at no point were they in the same room, like probably either on set or otherwise, they just didn't need to be. Yet each of their performances was elevating the other like crazy. The chemistry they had was as if they were right next to each other. Like it makes no earthly sense. And like, you know, Anne Bancroft doesn't need elevating, Sidney Poitier doesn't need elevating, yet. It's just crazy how they're playing off each other's energy, how convincing they both are. Like, God, Anne Bancroft shines in this. You don't doubt for a second that she wants to be done with everything. And God, I found it so moving, and it's going to be a movie that I recommend to people like for the rest of my life. I tend to really like sort of small scale slice of life things where you know, the stakes are high, but it does like there's not much of a ripple effect. It's really kind of contained and intimate and everything like that. And to me, it was just like such a powerful premise done to like near perfection by those two stellar actors.
Yeah, it's really. I remember I brought that home again back when I worked at the video store, and I had never heard of it, right? But I was like, oh, I like Sydney Pollack, right? And I like Anne Bancroft, I like Sydney Pollack. And I took it home one night, and I was like, Jesus, this is great. Like it was just that kind of like, and that was one of like, that's one of the ones I think about when I think about my days at the video store where it was like, wow, I really do miss discovering things like that. Because that's not a movie that most people have heard of at this point, right? I think if you asked even, well, most people probably couldn't name any Sydney Poitier movies at this point, but if you ask the average movie fan, give me five Sydney Poitier movies, they're not going to mention The Slender Thread. And you're like, but this is really good. That is a really, really terrific movie. So I'm glad you mentioned that one. And I'm also glad that you didn't mention the one I was going to bring up, because now we can talk about two different ones. The one I would say, and I know you like this movie as well, was A Patch of Blue,
Oh God.
where, oh my God, like you, Annie, I put it on, right? And I found it. I put it on. I was trying to find it online, right? I was trying to stream it, and it was only available for rental. And I was like, oh, all right, I'll pay $4, whatever. And then I have Canopy, which is the streaming service that goes through, is for free because it's done through your library. And I was like, well, you know what? I'm just not in the mood to pay $4 for something. Let me see if I can find something free from Sydney Poitier over on Canopy. And if there's something on Canopy that's free, I'll watch that one. And I go there and I put in Sydney Poitier and there's Patch of Blue. And I'm like, oh, well, great. I'll just watch it here. And I didn't have a lot of expectations for it because it was like, it's Sydney Poitier befriends a blind girl. And I'm a little like, I'm imagining how treacly that's going to be, maybe. And I'm watching it, and 5 minutes in, I'm like, oh, I'm all in on this one. This is, and that's another one. I'm like, how did he get nominated for that? It's such an amazing performance because this young blind girl, she lives with her mother, played by Shelley Winters, who is an absolute nightmare of a person and treats this poor girl so cruelly. And this girl wanders out and befriends Sidney Poitier and falls in love with him. And of course, she doesn't realize he's African American and that, what that might cause a problem. And he has a brother who is like, what are you doing? What are you doing with this white girl? Are you working some angle? And he's like, no, I just like it. I'm realizing by describing it does sound a little eye-rolly, but it is to me not handled that way. I thought Patrick Blue was just such a terrific, heartfelt drama about something you rarely see, which is again this the travails that this poor blind girl has to deal with in 1965, how the world is not at all built to help her. I mean, the world is like, just sit in a dark room. Don't bother us because you're handicapped. I thought that was such a great movie.
Oh God, like I honestly thought it was probably one of the best movies I've seen in years. And like what kind of blew my mind about it? Like I think I watched it, at the tail end of 2025, so like so many years later. And I feel like even in this age of like all these nods to various types of diversity, we're still very hard pressed to find a movie in the 2020s that hits on as many like socially pressing issues as this does. So you've got racial issues, you have disability issues, you have substance abuse issues, you have child abuse, child violence issues, you have just kind of basic socioeconomic, like they were very, very poor, just like they packed all of this in, and like you said, none of it felt forced. None of it felt like didactic, like, hey, you're supposed, like, finger wagging, you're supposed to learn something from this. No, it was just supposed to be a very, very real representation of what it might have been like for a blind girl, like, born in like squalor and just like all sorts of alcoholism, and with a very unloving family who
Ooh.
couldn't accept her disability. I mean, unloving is the
It's a
nicest way I
gentle
could
way of putting
possibly describe
it.
it. Yeah. It was just like none of it felt like it wanted me to like necessarily be a different person after it. And that is why I was a different person after it. Like it just, I got so many chills. And then of course at the ending is what really got me. I'm a sucker for really, really sad endings. And Sydney ultimately just says like, hey, this can't work. He sends her, I think he sends her off to like school. He
He gets
like
her
let
in. He gets her enrolled in a school for, I don't know if it's specifically just blind people or it's people with some sort of handicap, especially a special school. And he gets her enrolled in that because again, she lives in this little hovel apartment with her mother, who just basically turned her into slave labor. It's,
again,
oh
at best, like there, it was, you don't get a whole lot of time in that household, but they make every second count and they like just show her trauma. But at the end, he gets her into this school finally, like, this is something so great for her. It's the opportunity she's never had. He like sends her off. And he realizes at the last minute that he made the wrong decision. He chases after the car, but she's gone. And to me, that's just like a dagger to the heart. Like so much of it is a dagger to the heart. And I think one thing that's so powerful about it is so much of that doesn't even come from dialogue in the movie. You are just watching how, because she's blind, you're watching how these two are physically interacting. Like there's a lot of, touching and clawing around and like turning someone so that they don't, stumble over something. And you don't usually get to see love and affection played out so like literally every step she takes, he's there. And he has to worry what will happen if he's not there. But and to that end, a lot of what's powerful is just watching his face in the moments he realizes like this can't work. Like they'll be having a conversation, but because she can't read his face, we get to. He doesn't have to suppress anything, and it's just like so devastating. because as far as she knows, he's all there. He's not going anywhere. There are no complications here. Why would she think there were? And just it's amazing and like just an early career triumph. And God, that should have won over Lilies of the Field any
Oh,
day.
it's oh man, it really just totally got me. I was like, this is just such a great movie. So, and there's even other aspects to it that we're not even getting into, which again, if you're listening to this and you really just want to see a really great, well-observed drama about people that they generally don't make movies about, I would say give Patch of Blue a try. It's just absolutely great. So that and the Slender Thread, man. If I was booking like a Sidney Poitier marathon, like, if I was like, obviously you'd have to do In the Heat of the Night or Guess Who's Coming, like you would have to have one of the big ones, but I would like bracket it with like Slender Thread and Patch of Blue, right? I'd be like, that's our, you really got to see, these are really absolutely terrific movie. So okay, so what's another one that you want to talk about?
I want to at least give a very, very quick nod to something that totally caught me by surprise. Like I said, that his later career, even honestly past like the early 70s, it's just not as much for me. But one that absolutely caught me off guard that he also directed, and it was just a feel-good movie. Like, don't expect like a masterpiece. It was A Warm December.
Okay.
I don't know if you saw that one,
I
Rob,
did.
but
I did see that one, yeah.
yeah, just you spend the first, what, at least 45 minutes having no idea what's going on. There are these men following this woman
You're
around.
like, is this a spy movie? Like, what is this?
No, that's really what I thought for so long. And like Sidney's character ends up noticing this and sort of takes it on himself to protect this woman while he's just on vacation in London, was it? And
Forget.
I think some big metropolis where
Oh,
he's like,
Washington. No, Washington. They're in Washington, D.C.
oh,
That's
okay.
right. That's right.
So
They're in Washington, D.C.
no, yeah, okay.
Because he
And
works for the UN. I think he works for the UN in that one as well.
yeah, but
So
he's
he.
also just like randomly this dirt bike enthusiast, which to
Yeah.
him is amazing, like Sidney lore in the 80s. But the big thing, like the big surprise, is that the whole movie is about this woman who has sickle cell anemia, which at that point has become a really massive plague, kind of literally in African American culture. And they wanted to like amplify that, bring attention to it. And the men who were following her around were her brothers, right? Or they were even triplets, maybe? I don't remember. But like, yeah, they were just worried that she was going, because she had these kind of seizure-like episodes where she would be shaking, she'd get both warm and hot, and she would be kind of keeling over and all these things. And it was just kind of the most touching, just feel good sort of, even though it's kind of heartbreaking in a lot of ways. I can't
Well,
remember the other lead actor who she was, but I found her so appealing and so effective. And she was also like very, very self-sacrificing. She didn't necessarily want to come out and explain to Sidney's character what was going on and all that. She just kind of tried to keep him at arm's length to, in her mind, protect him in some way. And I found it really charming. Like, it's not a masterpiece by any means, but I was really interested in the types of things Sidney decided to do with his little director run. Like, lots of really interesting things and lots of, like, my conclusion with that, since I've watched all of them, was he was like taking the opportunity to just do something really different that he wasn't going to do in something directed by anything else, like by anybody else. He had those three movies with Bill Cosby that, like, we got to see him in a comedy. We got to see him do these like buddy comedies that were all just, I on like, I Bill Cosby, it was hard to watch him in that, given what we know about him now. But it was just kind of liberating to like for my soul a little bit to see Sydney just go full in to fun, like just unadulterated fun. Like you had a little like murder mystery. I can't remember which is which now, but they were all just fantastic. I think you watched all of them,
I did
didn't
watch
you?
all three of them. I was curious, by the way, everybody, just as a side note, as I mentioned in the intro, Sidney Poitier did have a whole side career as a director. He directed himself in a bunch of movies, and then I didn't realize that he was gone from movie screens for 11 years, focusing on directing and writing his memoirs. I didn't realize he was had that large of a gap. The last film he does in the 70s is the third film of this trilogy, the Let's Do It Again, and then he doesn't do another movie until the Shoot to Kill in 88. So I remember having seen Uptown Saturday Night, and I had not seen the other two, and I was like, oh God, do I want to sit through these with Bill? Can I laugh at all with Bill Cosby involved in this? So I gave it a shot, and Uptown Saturday Night is very funny. Cosby's not in it as much as you might think. Poitier actually takes really the lead in the first film. And then that one has Harry Belafonte doing a riff on Marlon Brando as the Godfather, which is absolutely fantastic. Like he's actually got the puffy cheeks and he's doing the
Yes.
whole, and it's right after the Godfather. Like it's like the next year or 2 years later. So it's, I just love that he's just kind of doing the voice and whatever. And I enjoyed it quite a bit, and I was like, okay, I can never get out of my mind what I know about Bill Cosby, but I can watch this and sort of put it aside for the moment. And then I watched the other two films, the Let's Do It Again, and then A Piece of the Action. And as I mentioned in the intro, I thought they were sequels. I thought he had done three. They had, and they're not. They play different characters, and it's a different setup each time, which actually to me is much more interesting. That they're having to come up with a new setup each time. It's not just a sequel. And you mentioned earlier, Sydney dancing. And I liked Uptown Saturday Night the most. I thought Let's Do It Again was a little weaker. And then I liked a piece of the action. But when I went to Letterboxd, I gave A Piece of the Action a whole half star rating up. I gave it a whole extra half star. Simply because at the end of the film, they just let the whole cast dance.
Yes.
Right? And they're clearly not acting anymore. It's them just dancing. And Sidney Poitier, and I was so charmed by that ending that as soon as I went to Letterboxd, I'm like, I'm giving this an extra half a star just for this final scene. I wish more movies did this. I loved it. It was so charming.
Yeah, and I believe in both, that's also in both To Sir with Love and To Sir with Love 2, they end with dance scenes. And that's actually extra interesting because A Piece of the Action had that whole it like he was in a school. He was working with, I think, young adults
They're
who
like
had
underprivileged kids and they're
responsibility.
trying to get them into this their school. There's this school is going to be shut down, and so Poitier and Cosby are trying to get money together to get the school refunded and get these kids get these kids back on track, kind of.
Yeah, and honestly, like a lot of the reviews I saw on Letterboxd were kind of tired of like the teacher angle, like especially with To Sir with Love and everything. Like, but to me, there were a couple parts of that that were just like so good that I kind of wished the whole movie had just been that rather than the whole crime backdrop, because you get whiplash going. Because like he's being kind of extorted, right? Someone is like
Yeah,
trying to
they're
get,
criminals. They're
yeah.
criminals, and they get forced into doing this to help out. Because the movie opens with like a heist scene, and it is you're just like,
Yeah.
wait, what is? And then it makes this turn. I'm like, what is this movie about? Like, so.
But and I think the guy who sets up Sydney's and Bill's characters like is a criminal who actually wants the two of them to reform. He feels like he can trick them into being better people, and you kind of believe it when when Sydney starts warming up to the students in the classroom and they to him, and there were just a few really powerful moments in that where I wish it had been two separate movies or so. It was like 2 hours and 15 minutes. It was just so long with a couple of very of plots that I found a little hard to they even if it made intuitive sense, like you knew what was happening, it was just jarring every time you went back and forth. But I loved some of those classroom moments so much, but I am kind of a sucker for that genre as a
Sure,
teacher myself.
of course, of
I
course.
like to think that some students come out forever transformed for the better, maybe because of me, or at least because of all the memories we create.
There's a really terrific scene where he brings out a bunch of his students, and he takes them and he wants to teach them like kind of basic lessons about like getting a job and like in interacting with the greater world, and he has. I'm trying to remember the scene because I watched it a couple of months ago, but it's like he has one kid go up to a stranger and say, "Can you give me directions to this building?" And he has the one kid like talk the way he normally talks, and he kind of uses a street lingo, and it makes the person giving him directions clearly a little uncomfortable. And so he kind of is like, "Oh, I don't know where that is." And then he has another kid talk kind of white and ask for directions, and he gets directions. And he's kind of showing that it's like, okay, all but who you how you engage with them, you're gonna get a different answer. They clearly everyone clearly knows you right because we're right in front of the building that you need to get to. But it's and he's trying to teach these kids this. It was interesting. It's too long, like you said, it's over 2 hours. And most comedies just should not be over 2 hours. You have to really justify your existence. But I did enjoy that it's three completely different setups. They're playing different characters each time. I thought that was unique. And the other thing I wanted to mention was he did do other movies. I mentioned Stir Crazy. He did Hanky Panky with, he worked again with Gene Wilder. But we're going to, fo I'm not doing, we're not going to focus on his directorial career as a solo director simply because his final film as director was Ghost Dad, starring Bill Cosby.
Ooh.
And while I am able to watch a movie with Bill Cosby as a co-star, I don't think I could sit through a whole movie where Bill Cosby is the thing, knowing what I
Absolutely.
know about him. So maybe some other day we'll do a Sidney Poitier's director episode, but that's what we're focusing on is on his acting career, at least for the sake of this episode. Did you watch Brother John?
I did.
What?
That was wild. I don't even I'm sure you have like descriptions in front of you and stuff, but to me that was a standout movie. I mean, like I said before, a lot of these things that he directed, to me it seemed like he was really exploring like genres and or I don't know. Because this is a whole genre unto itself. Like even by the end, you don't know exactly what happened. It has a sci-fi feel to it.
Brother, another Poitier movie that takes a very strange turn at the end. Very strange.
Yeah. And when you get to the end of a movie and you're like, okay, was the lead actor an alien? Was he God? Was he something in between?
Is he supposed to be like
I don't
the
know.
Antichrist?
Like what? Because he just like appeared on the scene anytime he was needed. Like you end the movie, you don't know really why he was there. You definitely don't know like what kind of creature he is or what precisely what special abilities he has, but he's clearly like quote unquote meant to be there. Like
It's a, yeah.
he has a purpose there of some sort. And I was just, yeah. I'm actually looking forward to watching that one again to see if I can get any sense. if watching it a second time, if I get any hints that I missed the first time, or if it really just is so like deliciously ambiguous.
It's a movie that you're like, wow, they really, this is what major studios were putting out in 1970, and God bless them, right? No pun intended. Like it was just like This is a wild swing, this movie. This is a wild, wild swing to have him in it. So, one movie of his that I did not watch that I want to mention briefly, obviously, it has to be brief because I didn't watch it, is called The Lost Man. And it is from 1969, which means it is right in the sweet spot of him at his the peak of his powers. And it is the description on IMDb is a gang of black militants plots to rob a factory to finance their revolutionary struggle, starring Sidney Poitier, for Pete's sakes. This film is like a lost film. I could not find it anywhere. It's not on any home video format, to my knowledge. It is not streaming anywhere. It is not on YouTube anywhere. Like it is, and I'm shocked that a movie made during this run where he was one of the biggest stars is just like it just doesn't exist. I could not find it.
I did find it and
Oh,
watch
you
it.
did? Oh, okay.
Might not have been 100% legally. It was just
Okay.
on. It was just on this Russian site for free,
Okay.
and there were a lot of I find a lot of classic Hollywood stuff there. Anyway, don't arrest me, please. But I was there were really interesting things about it. Most notably, it's the only time that you get to see Sidney acting alongside his life partner, Joanna Shimkus. And you can feel every iota of that chemistry between them. They're meeting for the first time here in this role. Actually, when they asked Joanna Shimkus to act opposite him, they said, "Oh yeah, this is starring Sidney Poitier." She said, "Who's that?" which is hilarious
Wow.
for the time, not to know him. But I think that's kind of its own little meet cute, actually, that she wasn't pulled into it because of him, and it was, but they ended up falling in love, and they were together until I think she died first. But yeah, that became a 40-year love affair. And but it was interesting beyond their on-screen slash off-screen relationship, in that it was the I believe it was the first role since A Raisin in the Sun where he was hard to like it, he was taking on a more controversial sort of role. He was really just a hardened criminal, did not give a fuck, and that was because in A Raisin in the Sun he's so human, at least. But when he falls into these crime roles later, that I just struggle with the genre in general. I wasn't particularly interested in the story, but there was really cool stuff happening with the woman who very shortly became his wife. Like you could truly feel it. It was fun. If you really want to watch it, I'll make sure to find a way to get it to you. But
Yes,
it was.
send me this illegal link because I just was shocked that a movie, most of his movies are findable. And then here's this one right in the center where he's a huge star. And I'm like, this thing is like, it just doesn't exist. It's just so very strange.
And there are no physical copies. It never hit VHS, certainly never hit
Everything
DVD.
hit VHS, right? How does a movie with Sidney Poitier not even hit VHS? That makes no sense to me at all. So he did do two sequels to In the Heat of the Night. Most people probably don't even know that. They did. The second one is called They Call Me Mr. Tibbs, which is like a little on the nose in terms of taking the famous line from the first film and just giving it the title of the second film. And then he did another one called The Organization. And you just mentioned you're not big on like crime films exactly. These are just, they're not bad, but they're just sort of crime thrillers. They're not anywhere near to the level of in the Heat of the Night. But I appreciate them in that it's like, here's another kind of trend setting thing. He's got his own series, right? He's not only is he the first African American actor who's like a leading man, he's got a franchise, right? In modern parlance. So I was like, that's cool. Like, I just like that he got to play Virgil Tibbs 3 times.
Over the course of almost 30 years, too. The organization, I think that was from, or maybe that was from the 80s. Maybe I'm thinking of
No,
Shoot to Kill.
they're all from the 70s. They're all from the 70s.
Right. Because there was another follow
He
his
did To
movie.
Sir With Love 2, like 20 years after the first one.
What was Shoot to Kill? Shoot
Well,
to Kill.
that's the one with Tom Berenger, where he's a they had their there's they're trying to they're trying to find a killer, and the
Okay.
killer, it's not related to Virgil Tibbs or anything like that, but it's in that one, there's a kid played by Clancy Brown, for the Kurgan himself from Highlander. He goes, he kills a bunch of, he kills this woman, he disappears into the snowy mountains, and they need to hire a like a mountain tracker to find him, and that's Tom Berenger. And that's what that movie is. That's Shoot to
That's
Kill.
right. Man, I was clearly losing some steam near the end of his career here. Like I just can't I can't necessarily remember which was which. But yeah, the organization. That like you said, those were all fine. I did there was just this moment in They Call Me Mr. Tibbs that I loved. Like they went really, really hard on just kind of cheesing up, like you said, with the whole title of the movie. There was just this moment where he was like walking really dramatically, like across the like police office, whatever, detective office. And like some there's this beautiful woman following him, badgering him with questions. The phone rings. He like does this dramatic three-quarter pirouette, picks up the phone, locks eyes with the hot lady and says, "Mr. Tibbs." Like it's just they really went for it. And that's kind of the last moment that I remember really enjoying of that film. Like it's just those things are kind of bland to me, but I find those moments to enjoy and throw into my Letterboxd reviews. Like that part was fun. That part was fun.
So he did he does he talk about in his autobiography like why he chose to not do movies for a decade? I mean, I know he said he wanted to focus on being a director. Was it that the and then so and then when he comes back, he does this Shoot to Kill movie, which is fine. It's not particularly great. It's a little defiant onesie, and that it's like, oh, these two are different. Will they get along? But it's, you know, like it's fine. It's just fine. And I'm kind of like, really? He doesn't do a film for 11 years and he comes back to do this? That seems kind of a strange choice. Did he get into that in the book at all? Like, did he want to just be a director at that point, and then that didn't really pan out, so he went back to acting?
I'm trying to remember. Like honestly, I listened to both of these books, but like quite a while before I got to that point in his career. I remember him passing over it at least, and just kind of, I at least remember some vague comments about like being interested in like trying to keep things fresh for himself and like trying to explore what controlling the narrative might look like if he were behind the camera or behind and in front of the camera, as it were. But I don't remember. It could have just been raising another set of kids with Joanna Szymkus, because he would have had a whole other herd of new children. I'm not sure. That's a really good question that now I'm interested to listen to those books again now that I've completed the filmography and these names would mean more to me. Honestly, like his memoirs, both of them, there's one from right around 2000, I think 1997, so same year as The Jekyll, actually, called Measure of a Man. And then there's another one from 2007 called Life Beyond Measure. He really likes the word measure. He even says that. But those are really interesting in that they're like so philosophical. The memoir from 2007 is from when he turns 80, and it's in the format of letters to his great granddaughter, who was just born at that time. Because he thought like, hey, I'm 80, I'm not going to be here that much longer. And then surprise, he got to be there for the first 14 years of her life, but he still just kind of delivers this, epistolary account of not just his life, but how he thinks about life. So if anybody was kind of drawn toward Sidney in all these various personas in his acting career and felt drawn to him in the way that I kind of described at the beginning, like kind of he's a little enchanting, he's magnetic, all this stuff. To me, those memoirs really fleshed that out. It was at least really meaningful for me as someone who like He had a whole chapter called Stargazing, where he just talked about like a bit about his friendship with Carl Sagan and just what he
Wow.
thinks about all the forces of the universe. I actually, on my birthday this year, I always hang out with my dad on my birthday, and I just said, "Hey, Dad, I know you love Sidney Poitier, and you're gonna love this," because he also loves Carl Sagan. And we just sat and listened to that chapter, and it's just mind-blowing. So I don't know if any listeners are just kind of drawn to like someone who just likes to wax philosophical in their later years. Like, no one does it better than him. Like, I was just blown away. Like, Sidney had a year and a half of formal education ever between the age of 11 and a half and 13. That was it. That was all. Like, he was technically in like acting school at the American Negro
Negro
Academy of
theater, yeah.
Theater, I think it was called.
Yeah.
And so he did that, but like just kind of, like what we think of in America as like traditional public education, he just didn't have that. And it's just amazing to hear this man so articulate at 70 and 80 respectively, looking at life the way he does, and someone who like became so famous but also still speaks with so much humility and realizing there's still a lot to learn even at 80. It's wonderful. I recommend it without reservation.
Oh, that's good to know. Did he seem, again, I don't want to keep asking you to speak for him through this book, but you've read it and I did not. Did he seem satisfied with his film career? Like he accomplished what he set out to do? I mean, I guess any actor probably feels like there's some things they wish they had done, but did he overall have a kind of like, well, I did a bunch of good work and that's important? Because again, like we just talked about, I think any actor who could say, I did Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, In the Heat of the Night, and To Serve with Love back to back to back, you'd be like, well, that's my career, right? That's I made three iconic films that will live forever. If I never do another movie, I've already left my mark. So does he come across that way in the books?
Oh yeah, to me he seemed overwhelmingly satisfied and pleased and gratified and tickled and like everything you could imagine. Like, he's just so, he approaches everything with such humility, but he never seemed to express any dissatisfaction, any longing for more. And if anything, he did touch on how he learned to like channel some anger from like when his family moved to Nassau in the Bahamas, and there were like they were mingling a lot with a lot more white people, and he withstood crazy near-death experiences with white people there. And then when he came to America, some really harrowing stories about his interactions with police when he's just a minor on the streets of Miami and all this stuff. So he found, you would never believe in a million years that he's this man with a bunch of anger and resentment in him, but he really found ways to channel it. And I always come back to thinking about No Way Out, that very first movie of his from 1950, where you described him as like so precise, and he could never really say what he wanted to say to
Right.
this really ungrateful, hateful patient he was caring for. And I think he just like had a style of processing his anger that was somehow still comfortable for white people. And that's just kind of amazing. And I think that is kind of what made him able to be successful in the way he was at that particular time when he was the only one doing it. And I think it happened a lot earlier than it otherwise would have, like in Hollywood. I think he was something really special, and I don't think anyone would deny he's a total trailblazer for so many things. And just, yeah, I think he was very satisfied, and I think he processed a lot through the roles he inhabited. And and sort of the people he got to explore, the characters, the minds, the emotions, the actions. That was the impression I got.
That's great. So we mentioned you mentioned The Jackal earlier, and that is his last film. So let's talk about The Jackal. It was released on November 14th, 1997. It stars Bruce Willis and Richard Gere, and of course Sidney Poitier. Let me get briefly to the plot. This is when a joint operation between the CIA and the KGB leads to the death of the younger brother of an international mob boss. The mob boss retaliates by hiring a professional hitman, the Jackal, to assassinate a prominent American for $70 million. FBI Director Carter Preston turns to an imprisoned IRA sniper named Declan Mulqueen for help, who agrees only on the condition that he be freed from prison. As the Jackal assumes a series of disguises and travels across North America to find his target, Mulqueen and Preston learn that there is a mole inside their organization, tipping the Jackal off to their methods of pursuit. Eventually, the target is revealed to be the First Lady of the United States, and so begins a desperate race for the FBI to stop the Jackal. Bruce Willis is the titular Jackal. Richard Gere is Declan Mulqueen. Sidney Poitier is Carter Preston. Diane Venora plays KGB agent Valentina Koslova. Matilda May from Life Force plays Isabella Zenkova. J.K. Simmons, a baby-faced J.K., well, he still looked like a middle-aged guy, but J.K. Simmons plays an FBI agent. A young Jack Black plays shifty arms dealer Ian Lamont, and Tess Harper plays the First Lady. It's directed by Michael Caton Jones, who did movies like Scandal, Doc Hollywood, This Boy's Life, Rob Roy. That's a very diverse career. The author of the original novel, Frederick Forsyth, who wrote Day of the Jackal, and Fred Zinnemann, the director of the 1973 film Day of the Jackal, were not happy that they were remaking this film, and they actually pressed Universal into changing the title to just The Jackal because they did not want a remake with the same title because they were apparently not happy with the script of this film. So what were your thoughts on the Jackal? For what are your thoughts of it as a movie, and what were your thoughts of it as a swan song for Sidney Poitier?
Oh my God, so many thoughts. First of all, I just find it really interesting that this one movie, or this one story rather, it has four different iterations. You have the novel, you have the movie from the 70s, you have the movie from the 90s, and then you have like a short series from
Yeah, they just
2024
did a mini series of it a couple, yeah, like a year ago.
where they bring back the original title of Day of the Jackal, but somehow you're supposed to intuit that they're all, it's funny to me. I think I haven't had a chance to watch the 70s version. I've heard that the series from a couple of years ago is actually outstanding. So I'd be really curious to see people really, really breathe life into something that for me fell a little flat. I can say that I did after a certain point find it kind of riveting, like just Bruce Willis's kind of just stone cold fuck 'em up attitude was just like it was almost a little mesmerizing to me. Just like even if like none of it was five star acting from anybody except maybe Sydney, like it was an interesting enough story. Even for like a crime thriller, it got my attention. I did think it was interesting that was the second movie in the 90s where Sidney was in some way in the FBI. I think that's kind of cool. In The Jackal, he is the deputy director, I believe, and is kind of he's calling all the shots, and everybody else is white. So, like, that's not half bad. I'm sure that was, I think that's more than like what we would today call a DEI nod. I think that's, I kind of respected it, even if it maybe was that, because you can't call anything with Sidney in it a DEI nod, because he elevates everybody and everything around
Yeah,
him to
he's
such.
Sidney Poitier, you know? You're like, wow, that's Sidney
Exactly.
Poitier.
I can say, like, as with a lot of like stuff in this genre, I have to find like small moments that really, really keep me going. And there were a few of those. I did just really like Sydney's whole commanding presence, but I was thrilled that even if it was like an undercover identity for Bruce Willis, he had a gay scene. And apparently, when they screened, they did an early private screening of this movie. I'm sure you read this. It's well known. Everybody cheered when a gay guy got randomly shot. Like the whole theater. And like, I'm a gay person. I want to see myself like better represented on screen. And just thinking about being in that theater in that moment, like I can't imagine. So what does Bruce Willis, like macho king of the 90s, do? He insists that they keep this small moment of him kissing another man. He fought and fought and fought. So props to him. Like, I wouldn't have been able to guess that he cared either way about it. He certainly acted that part well. So I really appreciated that. Like, even if Bruce was not supposed to be gay, if the, he's the Jekyll, he's the titular character. So even if he wasn't supposed to actually be gay, which actually, who knows, we're allowed to speculate. He doesn't even have a real name.
No, we
He,
never, right. We don't learn anything about him.
we don't know anything. He's barely human, and that's part of the appeal. But I did love that. I quite loved Richard Gere's horrible Irish accent.
Oh my God. It's like the
He
Lucky Charms guy. Oh, it's so bad.
was
Richard Gere, fine
nominated.
actor, but that accent, holy mac.
But he was nominated for an award for worst accent for that. He was ousted, like he was beaten at the last minute by somebody else. I can't remember who. But the thing is, like the way my brain worked with that, and I'm sure the way the casting directors and everybody else was, they were just like, well, he is a very good looking man. He can do whatever accent he wants and call it Irish, and we'll call it a day. That's, I mean, it was terrible, but I didn't let it distract. Well, no, it did distract me, but I actually got invested in his relationship with Major Koslova.
Okay. Diane Venora, yeah.
So basically, like, yeah, it's kind of just for everybody listening. Yeah, it's probably a cliche to have this hardened criminal who, gets recruited by the FBI to help them apprehend a really, really dangerous killer. Of course, like one of the people leading this whole investigation, the one woman in the FBI, as far as we see, falls in love with him. They fall for each other, and it's very heartbreaking and all these things. I actually got pulled in by that. But yeah, I don't know. The only thing I can say is I've watched it twice now. So as a
Wow.
word of caution to our listeners, it is twice as long the second time you watch it. I don't know how to explain that. I don't know the science behind that. But man, if you've seen it once and know everything that's going to happen, I think for me at least, it was really hard to rustle up the investment to watch the whole 2 hours again. And I even have a quote from the guy who was in charge of the script who wrote it, I believe. He said, "I never really liked the script. It was always too long. So I was trying to trim it as I went along, and I really made the film in the editing room, stripping a lot of excess away." So I'm wondering how much footage they actually got for the shortened version to 2 hours, because you never could have convinced me that this movie had already been shortened. Like, I don't know. I think maybe the crime movies are at least a little more interesting to you than they are to me, at least just looking at Letterboxd reviews as I was watching through stuff. But I don't know. I can't explain the science, but it is longer the second time.
The 70s version, I have seen the 70s version, and it's a great movie, but it's very dry, but on purpose. Like, it is just like not a procedural, but almost. And I by the fact that it's 1997 and they have to kind of like ramp it up a little and make it a little goofier and make it a little bloodier. Jack Black, I mentioned, plays this. It's Jack Black can only be Jack Black. You know what I mean? I don't mean that as an insult, but I mean his Jack Blackness just simply bleeds through, and he plays an arms dealer who sells this gun this massive gun to the jackal, and there's this scene where they go to test the gun out in the wilderness, and Jack Black has decided, well, I know that you're doing something illegal because there's no legal reason why you need to have this ridiculous cannon. And so he basically tries to extort the jackal by saying, hey, I know I told you the gun was going to be 10,000, but now I want 100,000 because if I don't get it, I'll rat you out. And of course, that's a mistake. And there's this long scene where the jackal basically just reduces Jack Black's body to pulp by shooting it with this gun, and he shoots his arm off, and it's fun, but it's very silly and very much like just not the style of Day of the Jackal. If you see the 70s film, you're like, this film would never do something like that, but this one needs to do that because it needs to have an explosion and it needs to have arms flying and blood shooting and everything. And it's just that kind of, and there's the whole subplot about the mole in the FBI. So there's a lot of that. I enjoyed it. It's like, I thought it was fine. Like, it's fine. You know what I mean? I did like Bruce Willis in it, and I did like Sidney Poitier. As I mentioned, Richard Gere's accent is just really horrendous. It's hard for me to take it seriously. I wish Sidney Poitier had a little more. Like, he gets to do a lot, but I don't think he gets to do much more than be the mechanism of the plot. Like, let's do this, let's do that, let me get this guy. And you don't like learn about a lot about the character. So it's almost like, wow, you don't almost really need Sidney Poitier, someone of this level, to play this part. I'm kind of
Exactly.
curious of why he did it and that he was clearly comfortable letting it be his last film. Now, I know he did some TV work afterwards, but he lived on, as we talked about, for like another quarter century. So he
Yeah.
obviously was comfortable with it being his final film because he probably could have been in another movie if he wanted to, but he chose to not do that.
Yeah, I was surprised by that too. You know, he's kind of dad. Like, okay, we gotta
Yeah.
ask dad before we can do this. He's the
Yep.
enforcer, he's the sanctioner. And like he has his human moments, but mostly he is kind of just like I'm the guy in the suit making the decisions, which honestly still for the 90s, like having a black actor do that, making him the deputy director of the FBI, I doubt that's actually ever happened. I don't know. I'm just guessing. I would have loved to see a little bit more of a mic drop from him. However, I will say, like, without going into detail about it at all, I watched he has two roles in like TV miniseries that meant a lot to him. One was playing Nelson Mandela. I haven't seen that one yet, but the other one was Separate but Equal, where he plays Thurgood Marshall, and he does talk like ad nauseum almost in his memoirs about just how much that meant to him, just because they're so ideologically aligned. And honestly, I recruited a friend to watch it with me, and I just remember texting her, you know, during his ultimate summation with Brown versus Board, and just saying, how is this not his like absolute final role ever? I do think that after playing Nelson Mandela and Thurgood Marshall, he was just kind of like, I did my thing.
What else is there
Like,
to do? Right.
yeah. And so it's kind of perplexing that we still get Shoot to Kill and The Jackal, and even a couple short years before that, like this 4-hour movie called Children of Dust. He was actually stellar in that too, about mostly about like indigenous relations and people trying to like assimilate into white culture. It was actually like really, really good. I didn't have the chance to finish it. I watched like 2.5 hours of it,
Wow.
which felt like enough, right? But
Wow.
so I was the Jackal, I have to admit, like the scene you mentioned with Jack Black, aside from like the gay smooch, that was my favorite scene, and Sydney was nowhere to be found. Like, because I just remember being like, man, like Jack Black did not stop talking. Like,
Yeah.
No space between sentences. And I was like, damn, I would have unloaded a whole machine gun. This guy, too. And like you said, we got like sort of Monty Python and the Holy Grail moments where his arm is off and now it's just a flesh wound. You know, just like we watched every second of this absolutely stone cold annihilation of this socially unaware stoner dude who knows a lot of the tech, you know, and that was honestly kind of satisfying. I don't know.
It's a
Like
fun
that.
scene, but it is so gratuitous that you are like,
It
okay, the
is.
movie is really like, all right, people want to see somebody get shot up with a gun. So, okay, great, 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 great. There is a
And like,
lot. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
no, just the only moment where I felt like, okay, Sydney's character has some triumph is at the very, very end. I think he said he was like he was kind of the stereotypical like, okay, I'm this law enforcement person with this one case I've never solved or this one person I've never caught. And I think it was someone in Australia. I could be wrong, but wherever it was, he just said, okay, I'm going to move to this place to live out the rest of my life, enjoy and in a new location. And if I catch this criminal that I've been trying to get for decades, that'll be the cherry on top. So I was like, okay, but we don't get any of his story until literally like the final 5 minutes of the movie, and then he's gone. So like I was glad to see something. And like, you know, in that his character is retiring, leaving the FBI. So it's like, okay, a small symbolic like walking away from Hollywood, but I wish there had been more.
I'm really glad you mentioned that final scene, though, because that's what was in my notes that I really wanted to mention was in the final scene of the movie where, you know, spoiler alert, everybody, the jackal has been caught. And the whole bit is that the Richard Gere character is in this IRA sniper. And as I mentioned in the plot synopsis, his condition for helping out is, well, I want to have my record expunged and be free. And there's this final scene with Richard Gere and Sidney Poitier where they talk about that basically Richard Gere's help was off the books because he couldn't be officially listed as having helped the FBI. So when the first lady's assassination plot fails, Sidney Poitier's character as the FBI director gets the credit because the Declan guy can't get credit. And he says to Richard Gere's character, you know, as far as the press knows and as far as the government knows, I'm the one that stopped the assassination. I did it. And he says, so I got the credit for it. And he's like, if I did nothing else, the rest of my career is set. The rest of my life is set because I did that. And I know that they weren't trying to sum up his career with that, because they clearly just weren't thinking like that. But I felt that it was an accidental kind of nice little bow, because it is like, yeah, he's Sidney Poitier. He's done, like, his, as I mentioned in the intro, the legend is secure. He did some of the greatest films of all time in the 60s. And if he never did anything past that, he's still Sidney Poitier and he still has those films under his belt. And I just thought that was a nice line to go out on of kind of like, if I do nothing else, I'm still set. And I'm like, yeah, because you're Sidney Poitier. So in this kind of dopey thriller, they had this little line that I thought was like, oh, well, that was cool. I kind of liked it. That's how he got, and that's like practically the last thing he ever says on screen. So I thought
Yeah.
that was cool. I did that.
I had forgotten about that one line, and that is kind of honestly, I really like that because, you know, like I'm an English major. I think of all like the symbolism that could be there potentially if because, you know, we want to read into that so we can see it. And just because his career really was about making things easier for other people. Like he did so much of the hard work and all this stuff, and it's almost like the roles are reversed in this final thing. Like Declan Mulqueen does all the heavy lifting in this particular investigation, and Sidney's character like still finds a way to thank him for that. And I don't know, that was powerful. And I also think, there is the separate but equal miniseries, but also To Sir With Love too. Like, he literally takes a bow at the very beginning. Like he's walking into this retirement party, everybody is clapping, he's reflecting on his time at that school, and like this character Thackeray is like tearing up and all this stuff. And it's, I think he got his final bows in, which, and like, I don't think anybody would disagree, but it is just kind of this mystery we'll never solve of like, why the jackal? And that's okay, right? I mean, thinking about kind of his temperament and stuff, maybe he never really wanted to go out on a bang, to just, maybe he made peace with just like, maybe he was planning to take another 11 years off, thought he would come back to it, never did. I don't
Never
know.
did. I mean, some actors probably don't think of it like that. They just, oh, that was good. I'm good. I'm happy doing. I'm playing with the grandkids. I don't need to bother with this stuff. I'm Sidney Poitier. I don't need to bother with this, you know? So, well, that leads sort of kind of coming back to what we were talking about with all the stuff with the Oscar talk. So that leads to my exit question that I wanted to ask you, which is, and I, like I said, I don't want to keep making it that like Oscars are the end all be all because they're not. But I can't help it because, and this is kind of the same question I asked previous month's episode about Thelma Ritter, which is, so Annie, what do you think? What film do you think he deserved an Oscar for? Not Lilies of the Field, but what you would have given him an Oscar for if you could have?
Sure. I've thought about this a lot over the past few months. Gun to my head, I would say Raisin in the Sun. Like, no questions asked. I would have loved it if he had actually won what he was nominated for in Edge of the City as well. That would be like my runner up. But he clearly expressed in his memoirs what you and I talked about, sort of the reservations he had about getting pigeonholed as kind of this black savior. This noble savage, sort of, and it was such a big part of his life. It wasn't just on screen. It was on the stage for, I think, 6 years before they took it to the silver screen. And it was just so trailblazing for everybody, for Lorraine Hansberry, who wrote the play, for all the actors who, like, people did not think that this show even had legs, like just in public on stage, because, like you said, it was made by Black people for Black people. And just seeing Sydney really step out of that box that we kind of, if not totally intentionally, boxed him into. And I don't, it was just so powerful to see that. And he was nominated for a Tony for that, didn't win it. He deserved some sort of flowers for that. I'm sure he was very happy with all of it and all the years of work he did on that, but it would have been great to just see some sort of trophy, some sort of medal to go along with just such a beautifully harrowing performance.
All right, agreed. By the way, we are recording this not terribly long after the Oscars for this year, and I just thought it was nice to hear Sidney Poitier mentioned on stage when Michael B. Jordan won for Best Actor, and he name checked all of the previous African American lead actors. It's sad that there are so few that you can name check them all in 30 seconds, but nevertheless, the first name out of his mouth was Sidney Poitier, and I just thought, well, that's awesome, right? It's just perfect that we're about to talk about this, and here we get to hear Sidney Poitier mentioned on screen. So, one last thing I want to ask you, and this isn't related to Sidney Poitier, I'm just fascinated by this, Annie, is how do you letterbox? And what I mean by that is, what is your MO? Because I think people approach things differently, how they rate things. And I'm just sort of fascinated about how people approach it. And the way I do it is, I tend to rate films by the kind of film they are, right?
Okay.
And that I say Animal House is a five-star example of a comedy. If you're making a comedy, it's going to be hard to do it much better than Animal House in terms of how funny that movie is, how inventive the performances, how iconic, how it's lived on forever. Lawrence of Arabia, 5 stars, right? One of the great historical epics of all time. So they're both 5-star movies. Would I say that Animal House is as good a movie as Lawrence of Arabia? No, of course not. But they're both they're exemplars of their type of movie. And that is how I tend to rate movies. I say, well, for the kind of movie it is, like Red Ball Express, it's another movie with Sidney Poitier I didn't mention. It's a great little war drama. For a war movie with no budget, no stars, it's involving. It's way better than you expect it to. It's directed by Bud Bedeker, who was a great director. And I actually gave it like, I think 3.5 stars. Is it as good as other 3.5-star movies? Probably not, but it's better than I expected. And for a cheap, quickie little war film, probably made in the hills of California, it's really pretty terrific. So that's how I tend to rate movies on Letterboxd. Now, how do you do it?
Oh, I wish it were a science. I wish there was
Okay.
something precise to it.
Not
But
as organized, right?
you really spoke to me at the end there. It was actually something I noticed as I was watching all of Sidney's films because, he's got a tremendous legacy that always precedes him. When you said expectations, I found myself always reviewing against my expectations. And like if they were disappointed in any way, if the hype had been greater to me than the joy I got, like I think my MO is really just kind of joy. How much joy did
Okay.
I get watching this? But sometimes I feel like I have to take actual like quality into account. But for some of them, like I had like the bar was the floor, no expectations. And it just like kind of like a warm December. It was just like I expected nothing from this, and it was, I thought
Gotcha.
it was a spy movie, and then it was actually the super socially conscious thing about illness and African American culture. I was like, okay, this gets, and it made me feel good, so this gets 4 stars.
Okay,
And
gotcha.
that's kind of an example of when I was just kind of surprised enough that I gave something 4 stars. I wish I could say I were like a real critic about it, but that's not my thing.
Okay. No, there's no wrong way of doing it. I'm just fascinated how different people approach it, right? There's just different ways
Yeah.
of doing it, and that's it's kind of, yeah, I'm sort of saying something similar to what you just said was the expectation, right? Because, like I said, like Red Ball Express, it was on YouTube for free. It looks like crap because it's out of, I'm sure it's out of copyright. So anybody can put it up. And Sidney was very young and and I'm kind of like, all right, it's probably just a pretty standard war film, but let me watch it. And then I was like, huh, okay, there's more to this. Oh, wow, there's a whole angle about white troops and black troops, and there's a whole side plot, and the war scenes are pretty good. So like I said, it's 3.5. Is it as good as other 3.5-star movies are good? Maybe not, but I was like you, I was pleasantly surprised. So like I mentioned for A Piece of the Action, pretty decent movie, but okay. But that dance scene is so fun that I'm like, okay, half more star just for that. He just gave it just for that. So I always find that sort of fascinating. What films do you have as your four favorites? Do you have four listed on there?
Great question. Yes. I've got The Last Waltz, of course. If
Okay.
anybody's listened to me on other podcasts, you know that I'm principally an expert on the band.
Yep.
This is interesting. I updated a lot. I also have Rushmore, Wes Anderson, 1998.
My favorite of his, yeah.
Oh my, same. This is gonna crack you up, Rob, these
Okay.
last two. Next, I have The Slender Thread. It really gets
Wow.
into me. Then I'm just watching your face here. I have Trog, Joan Crawford.
As a fourth favorite?
Yes, I can't even like I was turned
Okay.
on to it by listening to the Joan Crawford episode of this podcast.
Yep, Aaron Trotta Kelly is my guest, yes.
Everything I heard made me think, okay, this is one of those movies that's just gonna be a fever dream. Like I love like movies that are so bad that they're good and fun.
Well, that's
And
Trog.
oh my God, there are no words for it. And if we have like another 30 seconds though, I would love to plug my favorite such movie that Sydney was in.
Oh, go right ahead.
I can't recommend it enough. I just want to pull up my review of it because I think that's actually crucial because it contains all the gems in it. For this is a movie called Band of Angels from
Oh,
nine.
yes, you mentioned that on Blue Sky. Yeah.
I mean, there. First of all, there. I think I even posted a clip where Yvonne DiCarlo just like calls somebody white trash, and then there's this, da-da, like incredibly dramatic music,
You made a
which
gif out of that, if I recall
I
correctly.
did. Like a hilarious start to it, but there is this like absolute maybe 5 minute stretch that is the craziest freaking thing you've ever seen. Here's my review. There's literally a scene where a pirate has an arm wrestling match and Sidney Poitier mouths a sea shanty that's haphazardly dubbed over by some white dude's basso profundo. Yet people are still taking this movie seriously. Like I couldn't find a single review where anybody like had any fun. They just,
Wow. Okay.
I don't know. It was, yeah, a fever dream is the only word for
Who's the
it.
star of it? It's Clark Gable?
Yes.
Clark
Like,
Gable. Wow.
how do you have these kind of hard-hitting actors? Like, they were really trying to do something profound with race, with Yvonne DiCarlo as very clearly mixed race and how she navigated that. Because I think this must have been like 18th century, maybe early 19th, is my guess, is when it was set. So she was navigating interesting things, you know, just not being able to inhabit fully the white world or the black world. But yeah, I just obviously fixated on the
Interesting.
goofy stuff.
Okay. It's directed by Raoul Walsh, who's like one of the greats. So that's sometimes things just don't work, right? You pour all the talent you can into a movie and it just doesn't work. So, okay.
And it's over 2 hours long. That's the best part.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I did skip that one. So, I don't know. Maybe I'll watch it as a lark one day or something if we do a Clark Gable episode or something. But wow. Okay. Good to know. Good to know. Well, that is a diverse list, Annie. That
It
is a
is.
very diverse list. Last Waltz, Slender Thread, Rushmore, and Trog is those are four very different films. So, congratulations. It's a very eclectic film taste.
I'll take it.
Wow. Well, Annie, thank you for doing this. Thank you for your friendship over the years. It's been great conversing with you between the three of you, me and my wife. It's been fantastic. And I'm glad we had a chance to do this. I'm glad that you wanted to do the show. And I'm glad we had a chance to talk about Sidney Poitier because there's a lot of great stuff there. As we highlighted in the show, there's the classics that everybody knows. And then there's other ones that are really, really good. And so if you're looking for some really terrific movies, try Slender Thread, try Patch of Blue. There's some really, really great stuff out there. And he was just a absolutely fantastic performer. So thank you for doing this. And why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Sure. My handle literally everywhere is Jawbone Annie. I quit Twitter at the end of 2025, but my page is still there. So if you are into classic rock shit posting, there's a whole like 20,000 or so tweets that you can peruse. Otherwise, listen to my appearance on Pod Dylan the first time I chatted with Rob about 2.5 years ago, and as he said, blossomed into a wonderful friendship where we check in at minimum on every major holiday, talk about our dogs and our families. But yeah, that's kind of most of it. You can check out my website, annieburkhart.com, if you want to. But seriously, Rob, this was a blast. It was so great to talk with you again. Thank you.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'll mention everybody, like we did the Pod Dylan together, and then Annie happened to be back when we lived in the Northeast. We had Annie happened to be in town. And we had the three of us had dinner together, which was absolutely wonderful. I love that. You know, you make these friendships over the internet, and you know, they're just kind of like, well, yeah, they're friendships, but you've never been in the same physical space with somebody, and that's a different thing. And then we got to be all together, and it was just for a couple hours, but it was just wonderful. And so you're now at kind of one side of the country, and we're at the other side, but nevertheless, we've been staying together. And all the holidays, that get remarked. That's all my wife. That is all her doing. She is very attentive at that stuff. I am terrible, so I bask in the reflected glory of her attentiveness of that kind of stuff. So, hopefully someday we can get together again, Annie, in person. It would be fantastic. And so, thank you for doing this. I really, really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. And make sure you give Kelly a trigger warning before the part where we talk about John Cassavetes. So.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. She has a tough time with Mr. Cassavetti. So, well, thank you all for listening. You can find all the back episodes of Fade Out on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. You can find the show at Blue Sky under Fade Out Pod. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Monique D, Dominic Waters, Mark Balbus, plus David Escutierrez, Gold Torton, Al the Comic Guy, and Mike Atchison for your support of Fade Out and the Fine Water Podcast Network. So thank you all for listening. We'll be back with another episode next month, but we've reached the end of this particular script. So for now, it's time to fade out.
Present the award for the best actor, the very brilliant Academy Award-winning actress of last year, Miss Anne Bancroft.
The nominees for the best performance by an actor are Albert Finney in Tom Jones, Richard Harris in This Sporting Life, Rex Harrison in Cleopatra, Paul Newman in Her, Sidney Poitier in Lilies of the Field. The winner is Sidney Poitier in Lilies.
Because it is a long journey to this moment, I am naturally indebted to countless numbers of people, principally among whom are Ralph Nelson, James Poe, William Barrett, Martin Baum, and of course, the members of the Academy. For all of them, all I can say is a very special thank you.